they bail out like that. They say if you feed a speaker good enough, he'll shorten his talk. So, in conclusion, my name is Bill Sanders, and I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God, I'm sober tonight. And that is the single most important thing that I can share with you from this podium. That it is by the grace of a loving God and the tender loving care of people like you in rooms like this that I have not found it necessary to take a drink, nor even desirable to do so, since July 26, 1982. And I can assure you that that impresses me a whole lot more than it impresses you. It's good to be speaking in the South close to home. It makes it a lot easier for me because there are parts of the country and in some other countries and things where I've gone to share that I require translation. Even where they supposedly speak English, they don't speak Southern. You know, there are parts of these United States where, believe it or not, they don't know the difference between a conniption and a hissy fit. And there are places in this country where you say, give me some sugar, and they'll hand you a little sack of granulated stuff. I always like to be close to home where I don't have to explain things and I don't get these weird looks, at least for what I'm talking about. Sometimes for what I did, I get some real weird looks, but that's my story and I have to stick to that. It's always humbling to be asked to share at a gathering of recovering alcoholics. I love being around people in AA. People in AA bring out the best in me, and that's why I go to a lot of meetings and I hang out with a lot of drunks. There have been times when sharing was at first not humbling. I had a wonderful experience. It's probably one of the greatest experiences I could ever hope to have in recovery. In 1995, I was asked to share at Founders Day in Akron. And I sat on the lawn outside that big arena as between 18 and 20,000 people poured into that big arena there on the campus of Akron University. And we sat on the lawn, my wife and I and a couple of friends, watching the people stream in. And as the crowd grew and grew and grew, so did my ego. They're all coming to hear me. I am it tonight. And it grew and grew and grew right along with the crowd. And just about 15 minutes before we were supposed to go inside and my ego was at its height, a little bird flew over and pooped right on my shoulder. God works in mysterious ways. Put things in perspective really quick. But it's good to be with you tonight. If you don't want to hear about sponsorship, you may be in the wrong place. If you don't want to hear about the big book, you're definitely in the wrong place. And if you don't want to hear about God, you better run from the door for the door right now. Because those three elements, more than anything else, has brought me to where I am tonight, over 28 years without a drink of alcohol, a feat that I never thought I would ever see, nor frankly did I ever want to see. When I came to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was told, we're going to change everything about you, your life, we're going to change how you think, how you act, how you react, who you see, where you go, I'd have said, wrong place, wrong crowd, bye, I'm out of here. But I didn't hear that. All I heard was, don't drink today and come back tomorrow. Now, the first AA meeting I went to was actually several years before I actually became a member of this fellowship. I had a friend who was in AA and was going to a meeting, and I had expressed some element of curiosity. I can't imagine why. And so I went with this guy, and we kind of sat toward the back, and he said, "I'll explain to you what's going on." And, of course, they read all those things, and people raised their hands, said things in meetings that I didn't think I'd have told if I'd have been them. And then they got to the end of the meeting, and they brought this woman up the front of the room, and everybody started whooping and hollering. And I said, what's with this thing with this woman? Oh, that's Mary. Mary is celebrating. This is her 24th birthday. She looked a lot older than that to me. And then they gave her this poker chip, and everybody whooped and hollered about that. And then they brought out a little cake and gave it to her, and it had a candle on it, and she blew it out, and they whooped some more. And I said, "Well, this is really kind of weird. What is all?" He said, "Well, I'll tell you what, Bill. If you don't drink for a year, we'll do that for you." I said, "Now, let me get this straight. If I don't drink for a year, you'll give me a poker chip and a little cake. I couldn't wait." To get out of that nut house. I had a little box at home full of poker chips. And the 7-Eleven could sell me one of those little cakes for about $2.25. And I got to not drink for a year. These people are crazy. I didn't have a drink until I was 15 years old. I hear some people in this fellowship, they say they got drunk when they were 6 and they got drunk when they were 8. And it wasn't available in my house. I did not come from a family of alcoholics. At the age of 15, though, began my journey toward becoming a full-blown practicing drunk, an alcoholic. Now, the truth be known, today, I can honestly tell you that I believe that I was born an alcoholic. I believe that for the very first breath I took, all of the ism that was later to be cultivated by alcohol was already in place. Because from my very earliest memory, I exhibited many of the things that we talk about in these meetings, like a feeling of not belonging, of not fitting in, a feeling of being a square peg looking for a square hole and they all kept turning up round, of feeling like somehow everybody else had something or knew something that I didn't have, that there was a layer of something absolutely missing from me. I was a scared little kid, scared of people. I spent most of the time when I'd be in a situation with a bunch of people looking at my toes. Couldn't look people in the face. Just wasn't part of my character. At the age of 15, though, some friends, out of curiosity or peer pressure, said to me, "You want to go over to Carolina and buy some beer and drink?" And I said yes, and we crossed over the Savannah River into South Carolina from my little hometown in a dry county. And it was a beer joint that you could pull up behind it and honk your horn 3 times. A guy'd come out, and if you could see over the steering wheel, he'd sell it to you. And we bought what I'm pretty sure I remember was a case of Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. And came back and sat on the banks of the old muddy Savannah River. They say you ought to go back to where you had your first drink sometime just for old time's sake. I can't do that because where I had my first drink is about 300 feet at the bottom of Lake Hartwell, but there was no Lake Hartwell there then. And someone popped open one of those beers with one of those old church keys. Some of you are old enough to remember what a church key is. It didn't open churches. And they handed me that beer, and I took a great big swallow of it, and it was without a doubt the most vile, putrid, god-awful tasting stuff I'd ever put in my mouth, which probably explains why I only drank 6 that night. It tasted terrible, but that night, I don't need to tell you what happened between the second and the third beer. All of you in this room who are qualified to be a member of this fellowship know. All of a sudden, little Billy Sanders wasn't scared anymore. And all of a sudden, I was smarter, and I was wiser, and I was handsomer, and I was funnier, and I was sexier than I had ever been in my entire life, or for that matter, anybody I'd ever known in my entire life. And that night, there was a set of beliefs set in motion for me that were to follow me for more than a quarter of a century. One of those beliefs, the primary one, was that alcohol affected everyone who drank the same way it affected me. I know today it doesn't. There are some people out there who can drink a drink, and it doesn't change their personality. It doesn't demand another. It doesn't make them into something that they are not. It doesn't make them forgetful. They have a drink, and they relax and go about their business. It also set into motion some people that I do not understand. I did not understand them 40 years ago, and I don't understand them today. For example, the person who says, no more for me, one's my limit. That has got to be the stupidest remark I ever heard in my life. I've never wanted one of anything. Anything worth doing is worth overdoing. But the one that really got me, and still to this day does, it just makes no sense at all. The person who says, no more for me, I'm beginning to feel it. That is not where you stop. That is where you get going good. I don't understand those people. I never did, and I never will. And what's more, I know today, those people never understood me, and they never will. And a long time ago, I quit trying to make them understand. I didn't think anybody would ever understand me. I always knew I marched to a different drummer, that there was something that was missing in me that I was afraid I was never going to find, but that I was going to spend a lifetime searching for. And that was what I called the search for it. The it that was missing in me. The it that I came down the chute without. That layer of whatever that everybody else seemed to have that I didn't have. I called it the search for it because it's a hard, tough search when you're looking for something and you don't know what it is you're looking for. But you start looking nevertheless. And for over a quarter of a century, I searched for it. I searched high and low. Through a lot of years, it was mostly low. I thought, for example, at one time, that if I had enough money, that would be it. If you can't identify it, buy everything and you'll end up with it. And at one point or two during my working career before I retired a few years ago, I made a great deal of money, comparatively speaking. And I found that money was not it. I thought if I had enough stuff, you know, enough big enough cars, fancy enough TVs, stereos, the fancy enough stuff, the stuff would be it. It most assuredly was not. I thought if I had enough power and prestige, and there were times when I tasted both and found that they were not it, that it did not change. No matter what kind of power I managed to wield, it didn't change that feeling inside of being less than and not belonging, not fitting, no matter where I was. I didn't drink that much in my little hometown. It was a little town of less than 3,000 people back then, and if my little Southern Baptist mother had ever caught me drinking, I would not have needed Alcoholics Anonymous. I would have needed an undertaker. But then I went off to college, only 40 miles from my hometown, to the metropolis then of Athens, Georgia. And I spent 4 years in that town. Sorry about that, Wynn, for you North Avenue, your North Avenue trade school boys. The prestige of being a bulldog wasn't it either, so. I spent 4 years at the University of Georgia, and I would like to share with you some fond memories of my college career. I really would love to. But by then, I was beginning to suffer from what we call in North Georgia spells. We have another name for them around here. They're called blackouts. 1961. That was a blackout. I got into a lot of trouble in school. I was constantly in trouble in school and became a thorn in the side of the beloved Dean of Men of the University of Georgia, that if any of you were back in at the university during that era, was a man named Bill Tate. And fortunately, Bill Tate took a liking to me, and it became a cause for him to see that I graduated with a piece of paper in my hand. And I think without him, that wouldn't have happened. Because I constantly was in his office, and his standard greeting to me was, "You again?" Just an example, they've got a wonderful old tradition at the University of Georgia that after every Georgia football victory, they ring the chapel bell in the tower at the chapel of the University of Georgia, and the chapel bell will ring from the moment the game is over and Georgia has won till midnight, except on those nights when we beat Georgia Tech and it rang all night long. It's been ringing all night long a lot in recent years. It's a great honor to be a bell ringer. They put your name in a roster that's housed at the University of Georgia Library, and you can go all the way back to the turn of the century and of the last century and see who rang the bell after which game and which victory. It's a great honor. And I rang that chapel bell. My name's not in that roster. Now, Dean Tate explained that that had something to do with the fact that I was ringing the bell at 2 a.m. on Easter Sunday. In case you're not a big football fan, the season's pretty well over by then. And there were a lot more experiences like that at the University of Georgia, but that's one of the few that I can really remember. After I finished school, I went to work in Atlanta, and I should back up a little bit and tell you that I retired about 4 years ago after spending 50 years in my profession. At the age of 13, in a small hometown radio station, I became what was purported back then to be the youngest disc jockey in America. And it was to make money to go to college, and I had no clue that I would spend 50 years in that profession, but that's how it turned out. And I did a little bit of everything from disc jockey to newsman to news anchor to talk programs and management, a little bit of everything else. But I went to work here in Atlanta and worked here for a while, and ended up across the way in Gainesville, Georgia, working for a radio station there. And along the way there, I met a beautiful girl, had a couple of dates with her, decided I really liked her and wanted to make her a part of my life, but I knew I probably needed to kind of cut down on my drinking a little bit if I wanted to do that. A couple of more dates, I discovered that was not necessary at all. That woman liked to drink just as much as I did. We met on April the 15th. We got engaged in June, and we were married in December. We didn't mess around. And, of course, everybody said that marriage wouldn't last, and they didn't know how right they were. That marriage ended up most assuredly on the rocks. I worked, as I said, in broadcasting for 50 years in a lot of phases of it. I had a lot of great experiences. I met a lot of great people and had the opportunity to go and do a lot of things that have left me with great memories. And there are a lot of things that happened along the way that I wish hadn't happened. A lot of crazy experiences. I've shared from these podiums one in particular that I'm always asked about. I was sent by my boss at WSB Radio, the news director, one day to downtown Atlanta to do an interview since nobody else was around to do it. But I grabbed a tape recorder and said, where am I going? He said, you're going down to the Dinkler Plaza Hotel and you're going to do an interview. You go up to the 14th floor, and I think that was the floor, I'm not sure, and the Secret Service will be waiting for you. I said, the what? The Secret Service. I said, who am I interviewing? He said, you're interviewing Lyndon Johnson. Yeah, wow. I get in the mobile unit and I start downtown and said, no way in the world I can do this without a little bit of fortification. So I stopped at one of my water holes and I walked in. I had a couple of quick shooters, got back in the car, went on down, parked the car, got on the elevator, went up and was met at the elevator door by the Secret Service, and I was frisked and checked and my credentials were looked at, and they opened up my tape recorder and looked at all everything. Then they ushered me into the parlor of this fancy hotel suite. And this giant of a man went over and grabbed me by the hand and said, come on in, boy, and have a seat. And I walked in, I sat down on a sofa, and he sat down on a sofa, another sofa facing me. And I noticed on the table between us, the coffee table between us, there was a couple of glasses and a jug of Jack Daniels. He said, before we do this thing, let's have us a little snort. Sounded good to me. So he poured my glass full and he poured his glass full and we began to talk. Now I should point out to you that back then you didn't just walk in and interview the President of the United States. You had to do what was known then as the pre-interview interview. That's where you tell him what questions you're going to ask him and he tells you whether or not he's going to answer them. They don't get away with that anymore today, but they did back then. And so we began to talk, and I started laying out the questions, and he was saying, yeah, well, yeah, we can go into that. And he would tell me a little bit, and then I would take a few swallows, and every time I'd take a few swallows, he'd grab that bottle and fill that glass back up to the top again. About 10 minutes into this thing, I'm sitting there going, holy crap, it's getting hot in here. Then a few minutes later, it kind of hit me. My God, this man is drunker than you are. A couple of minutes later, he said, turn that thing on, let's do it. And I turned on the tape recorder, and we started the interview recording it. And it was a good interview. I asked some very good questions. He had excellent answers. The interview was going along just as smoothly as it possibly could until I got to one question. I asked him a question about his wife, Ladybug. Now, here's where I can always gauge the age of the audience. Because there are a lot of young faces looking around going. For those of you youngsters, his wife's name was Lady Bird, not Lady Bug. Thank God he thought that was funnier than y'all did. There were a lot of other crazy experiences that happened, and I traveled a lot in my career as a broadcaster, and traveled to a lot of places all over the country. And I used to say that I had a fear of flying. I've since come to realize that I never did really have a fear of flying. I had a fear of was falling. And so I would always get out to Atlanta Airport a little bit early and go in the bar and have a few drinks, get fortified before I'd get on that airplane. I mean, you know, I don't even like airports. I mean, a place where you go fly out of and they call it a terminal. That's kind of scary to start with. But I'd have a few drinks and go, you know, before I'd get on the plane, but which always worked real well, except except for those times I'd forget to get on the plane. Now, some years ago, some of you may remember, our hometown airline, Delta Airlines, had a series of commercials, which ironically, I did the voiceover for some of those commercials. And the slogan that I read over the what was seen on TV was one line. The line that I read in the commercial was, "Delta is ready when you are." Uh-uh. They lied. Because they'll leave you. So I just do what any good drunk would do. I'd get on another airplane and go somewhere else. Call home that night. "How's the convention in New York?" "I don't know. I'm not in New York." "Where are you?" "I'm in New Orleans." Along the way, my wife and I are blessed with a beautiful little blue-eyed, blonde-haired baby girl, a gift, true gift of God. And I was determined to become the world's best dad. And I kept that promise for a good couple of months until I discovered, we discovered, the great American institution of the babysitter. And then I was right back out in my drinking career. And for the first 12 years of my little girl's life, I was an absent father most of the time. Because more and more often, I didn't show up at home. More and more often, I woke up in strange places, in strange beds with strange people. More and more often, it reached the point where my wife no longer cared where I was when I didn't come home. So when I finally did come home, she didn't bother to ask. And more often, I came to realize much later that the only look that was ever in my little girl's eyes was a look of fear and of hate and of disgust. But by then, my disease had outfitted with me what I refer to as my alcoholic blinders. They only allowed me to see what my disease wanted me to see. It didn't allow me to see that my little girl didn't invite friends to come spend the night anymore. She never knew when Dad's coming home in the middle of the night in a drunken rage, smashing furniture, belittling her, calling her names, and emotionally abusing her and her mom. Even to the extent when we were putting a new mattress on my little girl's bed and I picked up the old mattress and underneath I found a diary and I did what I shouldn't have done and I opened it. And the words jumped off the page. "I wish my daddy was dead and maybe there'd be some peace in our home." But the blinders were firmly in place. How dare she? I believe from the bottom of my heart back then that my drinking affected no one but me, and it was nobody else's business. I thank God today for the wonderful men and women of Al-Anon who have helped me realize how the tentacles of my disease reached out and touched, if not destroyed, every single person that came in contact with me. I tainted the world around me. And all of it was in this great search for it, a fitting of belonging. I used to do a lot of entertaining in my business. And in business, I always entertained by taking people to the fanciest restaurants and lounges in Atlanta. The ones where I could walk into and the maitre d' in his tuxedo would greet me at the door by name and usher me into the lounge. And before I even reached the bar, the bartender would have my drink poured and sitting in front of my usual seat. And I loved taking people in to see that because I felt like it made a statement about who and what I was. I know today that it most assuredly did, but it was not the statement that I thought it was making. I became a snob about drinking. I would tell you that the optimum temperature for drinking vodka is 31.5 degrees Fahrenheit. I learned that that was incorrect. The optimum temperature for drinking vodka is 108 degrees Fahrenheit, because that's the temperature underneath the front seat of my car where I kept that vodka bottle. I considered myself for a long time to be a social drinker. I came to know and to realize that if you have to drink in order to be social, you are most assuredly not a social drinker. And that's what I was. I thought I was a classy drinker. But I'm going to tell you something. When you wake up in the morning and you look down and there's dew all over your clothes, and you blink your eyes and realize that you are looking out from underneath a bush in Piedmont Park in downtown Atlanta, and you blink again and realize you're looking up the nostrils of a policeman's horse, that ain't classy. It's also no good answer to the question of what are you doing here? All I could think of was, where is here? It is not classy when you're dragged from a car that you've planted into a steel post on the side of an Atlanta city street. And you're frisked and cuffed and put into that cage in the back of the cop car and hauled off to jail. The whole time I'm telling this young cop, you're making a big mistake. I am not drunk. I have only had two beers. You're making a big, big mistake. A little side here that I've been sharing recently that something that came to me not too long ago. I'm convinced that there's this school somewhere that all of us alkies at some point in our drinking career are whisked off to when we're in a blackout. And at that school, they only teach one thing. If ever stopped by the cops, never admit to more than two beers. If you watch these cop shows on TV, guy gets out of the car, falls flat on his face on the ground. Mister, you had a little too much to drink? Nope, two beers. Wife and I are watching one about a couple of months ago, and this guy gets out of the car. Guy props him up against the car. He slides down, kabloop, on the ground. Cop looks down. Mister, you had a little too much to drink there, huh? No, I hadn't had but three beers. I went, oh, God, he missed class. Anyway, I'm telling this cop I can't be drunk. I have not had more than two beers. He hauled me into the police station. He put me on that breathalyzer doohickey, and I blew on it as hard as I could, and he got through, and it registered .28. I said, now just wait. There's no way in the world I could be registering .28 on two beers. Cop agreed with me. I can assure you it was the only thing we agreed on. It is not smart, nor is it classy, to go to court for a DUI drunk. If you have never done that, don't. Judges don't like it. I had a friend who was a lawyer. The lawyer told me, this is no big deal. This is my first DUI. Walk into court, when they call your name, they ask you, how do you plead? You say, I plead, Your Honor, I plead nolo contendere. So what does that mean? He said, that means you plead no contest, not guilty, not innocent, just no, nolo contendere means no contest. He'll slap you on the wrist, he'll give you a little fine, and you'll be on your way, and all will be over with. Okay. Well, I got fortified to go to court. Got in the courtroom, they called about 6,000 names before they got to mine. Finally, the bailiff or clerk called my name. Mr. Sanders, how do you plead? I stood up and I looked at the judge and I said, Your Honor, I plead numle ro mais renum no, no guilty. And he threw the book at me. Along the way, of course, my family life is falling apart. My search for it is beginning to wind out. I finally did reach the conclusion that if I just had the right woman, that would be it. I knew the one I married to was not it. If I could just find the right woman, so I would visit a lot of bars. And I would sit in those bars and sit at the end of the bar, and I would watch the women come and go, and I would look at, down at the end of the bar, and I'd see this wonderful vision of loveliness sitting at the other end of the bar, beautiful flowing hair. And I would sit that bar for about the next 10 minutes planning the greatest come-on line the world had ever heard. And I would rehearse it over and over and over again until I had it perfectly set in my mind. And I would slip off my stool and go down to the other end of the bar and slip quietly onto the stool next to this beauty. And I would turn and look at her, and she would turn and look at me, and I would look into the pools of loveliness of her eyes and open my mouth and say to her, a slab out by be valiant valiant. And I knew she was it because she'd say, yes. I got to tell you, I shared this a few years ago at a roundup called the Gopher State Roundup up in Minnesota. And they have, and it's about 4,000 people in there, and they have over the side a big screen thing, and they have a person doing translation or interpreting for the hearing impaired. And I got through what I said to the girl, and the woman that's doing the hearing impaired is standing there like, I still don't know what she translated to them. On the 8th day of April of 1982, a usual event happened at my house. I'm sitting in my recliner chair watching, staring at the television, and my wife comes through the living room and doesn't say a word. We weren't talking much those days. And she got in her car and left, and she was gone for 2 or 3 hours, and she came back and walked in the house. I'm still sitting there in my recliner chair, still staring at the television, probably trying to decide whether to turn it on or not. And she said, guess where I've been? And I said, who gives a, who cares? And she did something really weird. She didn't say a word. She flipped a white poker chip into my lap. And I looked at it, and I looked back at her, and I looked back at it, and I said, I don't know where you've been, but if that's all you won, you had a lousy night. Well, she told me where she'd been. She said she had been to an A&A meeting. And I went into an absolute flying pluperfect rage because I knew beyond any shadow of a doubt there was no way on the face of God's green earth that that woman was an alcoholic. No way. Because if she was an alcoholic, then she just couldn't be an alcoholic. That's all there was to it. But she didn't care what I thought. She just started going to meetings and going to meetings and going to meetings and going to meetings and going to meetings. Some dang fool nonsense about 90, 90, and 90-something. And I'm waiting for the other shoe to fall. I'm waiting for her to say, you're a bigger drunk than I am. You need this worse than I do. None of that. She just kept going to meetings. Not a word said. Not a word. Few little hints left around the house. Like I'd go in and lift the toilet seat, and there's how it works, taped to the lid. Finally, the other shoe fell. She said, I'm going to pick up a 90-day chip, and I'd like you to be there. I said, oh, ain't going to happen, not in this life, no way. A few tears, a few deals, and I said, okay, I'll go on one condition. I'm going in my car. I said, where are we going? She said, follow me. She said, we're going to a place called the 8111 Club. See a few nods of people who know where that is. A little clubhouse on Roswell Road, sitting up in a little grove of trees. And I followed her. And as we turned in that driveway, I thought, this is really weird. Because, see, I'd passed that place 100 times on the way home from the bar. And every time I'd pass there, I'd go say, Bill, you ought to get to know the guy that lives in that house, because he obviously has a party every night. Well, that night, old Bill went to the party. Slipped down behind a post in the back of the room, and for the next hour witnessed the biggest bunch of weirdos I had ever seen in my life. They read all that stuff at the beginning of the meeting, and about the time they got through with that, there's this guy doing this, waving his hand. I'm going, wish somebody hurry up and tell that guy where the bathroom is so he can go. Instead, they pointed to him, and he stood up, and right out loud, he told them his name and said that he was an alcoholic. Just as I'm thinking, I don't think I'd have told that if I'd have been him. He told them he had gotten 3 DUIs. And you know what those people did? They busted out laughing. And the thought going through my head was, why are they laughing? Don't they know what they are? They're alcoholics. They've got nothing to laugh about. I say that tonight because I thank God every day of my life for the laughter that we share in these rooms. Because there is magic, and there is power, and there is healing in that laughter. And wherever I go, I tell people, if you don't have a home group that laughs a lot, go find one that does. I always kind of quietly like to tell the newcomers, don't laugh all the time or they'll come get you. But I didn't get it that night. Next guy, 6 DUIs, arrested for indecent exposure. They came unglued. I'm going, my God, if they knew some of the stuff that happened to me, I'd sound like Richard Pryor. Meeting finally got over and everybody scattered and I headed for my car as fast as I could get out of this crazy place. And I got almost to my car and something grabbed me by the shoulder that felt like a steel vice, spun me around, and I found myself looking up into the face of a man 7 feet 11 inches tall. I can tell you tonight he was only 6'6", but he looked a lot taller that night. This guy was a little different from the other people in the meeting. I remembered him. Everybody else has introduced themselves by names. My name's Joe. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Mary. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Sue. This guy was different. When he introduced himself, and some of you are going to recognize the name. When he introduced himself, he said, howdy, my name's Floyd, and I'm a grateful hillbilly drunk. And I was thinking, give me a break. And he starts talking to me about drinking moonshine up in the mountains, and about his fifth grade education. And I'm standing there thinking, my God, why is he telling me all this? The guy don't even know who I am. I found out he knew exactly who I was because she'd been talking about me in those meetings. People coming out and getting in their cars and pulling out of the parking lot and leaving. Remember now, I went in my own car so I can get out of here. My wife comes out, smiles, goes, bye, gets in her car and leaves. And it's me and Floyd. And he talks to me about his DUI he got driving the school bus. And about getting drunk out in the woods in the wintertime and falling down on the ground and his face freezing to the ground. And they had to pour coffee on him to get him up. Now, I'm not hearing most of this because I'm busy making a deal with God. Floyd talked on there for about, I don't know, 3-4 days. I finally got away from him, got in my car, walked in the house. When I got home, my wife started to say something. I said, don't open your mouth. Don't you ever try to get me back to that nut bin again. And she didn't. And the roller coaster ride continued. Down, 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 down. The loneliness, the misery, the search for it was gone, long gone. It was over. There was no it for this man. The afternoon of July 26, 1982, I came out of a week-long blackout drunk, whole week missing. When I came to, I'm sitting in my old recliner chair, and in my left hand was an empty bottle, and in my right hand there was a fully loaded and cocked .22 pistol, and I had not remembered picking up either one of them. And the thought going through my head was simply this: is this all there is? Because if it is, you can have it. And through the fog of that wretched hangover, there came a voice. The voice of God, not directly. The voice of an angel, not exactly. It was the voice of a beautiful, wonderful, lovable, strapping, hillbilly drunk named Floyd. And the words that cut through that fog were simply this: when I came to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I expected God to open the gates of heaven and let me in. He didn't, but he opened the gates of hell and let me out. And if where I was on that evening was any closer to hell on this earth, I hope I never know it. Now, I have to tell you a little side story now. Last fall, the man named Floyd Blackwell, who showed me the final walk into Alcoholics Anonymous and became a friend for the next 27 years, passed away. Nearly 40 years sobriety in this fellowship. And very graciously, his son asked me to do the eulogy at his memorial service. And I stood before those people and was able to say, last Saturday, God did open the gates of heaven and let Floyd in. And I have no doubt that he said, welcome home, my good and faithful servant. A man who dedicated his life to helping alcoholics. And this guy here would have thought God would at least have sent me a PhD. But my God has always known exactly what and who I needed in my life. I got up out of my chair that evening and I walked into the bathroom and I cleaned up as best I could. I went and gargled about a half a bottle of Listerine, drank the rest, got in the car and drove back to that little house on the hill and walked in and sat down behind the post in the back of the room. Now, I don't know about the God of your understanding, but the God of my understanding most assuredly has a sense of humor. Because sitting there at the front of the room, chairing that meeting, was my wife. She didn't see me until the end of the meeting, when a man got up and explained those chips, and I got up and I took the longest walk I've ever taken in my life to the front of that room. And a man pressed a white poker chip into my trembling, sweating hand. And I walked back and sat down. I choose with all my heart to believe that an old Bill Sanders walked to the front of that room that night and died, and that a new one walked away. Because as I said at the beginning, by the grace of God and the tender loving care of people just like you in rooms just like this, I have not taken a drink since that day. You told me I needed to get a sponsor. I thought that was weird. I said, I'm in radio and television. I got lots of sponsors. He said, that's not the kind we're talking about, and you explained it to me. And I decided to do that scientifically. So I looked around for the kindest, roly-poliest, white-haired old granddaddy that I could find. One that I knew would pat me on the head on a daily basis and say, I've never seen anybody work a program as good as you, and I wouldn't change a thing. Took me a couple of weeks, but I found him. Snow white hair, perpetual smile a mile wide, roly-polier than I am. And I asked a man by the name of Doc Crandall to be my sponsor. Biggest mistake I ever made in my life. I knew I was in trouble the first day. He said, sure, son, I'll be your sponsor. Let's talk about the rules. Rules. What rules? He said, don't worry about it. It's very simple. You're going to wake up every morning. You're going to roll out of that bed onto your knees. And you're going to ask God, as you understand him, to keep you sober today. And the last thing you're going to do at night is you're going to get back down on your knees and you're going to say thank you before you get into that bed. And I said, now, okay, Doc. Now, I grew up in a Southern Baptist church. Every time the church doors opened, when I was a kid, we were there. Got a long way away from it, but I do know prayer is important. God knows y'all open every meeting, close every meeting. But, Doc, I just have to be perfectly honest with you. I'm just not comfortable with this knee business. He said, I don't remember saying a damn thing about you being comfortable. Well, I drew myself up. I mean, he can't talk to me like that. I got almost 30 days. I said, I thought this was a program of suggestion. He says, it is. I suggest you do it or get you another sponsor. That's how we began our walk together. And then he gave me that book. He said, I want you to take this book and take it home, and I want you to study. I didn't say read. I said study the first 164 pages of that book. And when you've done that for a few weeks, I want you to come back here, and we're going to sit down and talk about how you can make those principles in that fifth chapter work in your life. And I said, all right, I can do that. Got me some sharp pencils and some legal pads and some highlighters, and I went home and I went to work. I opened that book up, started I reading, and I started highlighting, and I started underlining and making notes in the margin and writing in that legal pad, and I went at it just as fast as I could, as hard as I could go. I struck through the steps that didn't have anything to do with me, and I jotted down a few I'd thought of that y'all obviously hadn't. In about 3 weeks, I called him and said, Doc, I'm ready to talk. He said, hot dog, come on over. I went over to his house, walked into his den. He reared back in his big old recliner chair, and I spread all my stuff out on his coffee table. He said, all right, son, lay it on me. I flipped the big book open to chapter 5, and I pointed down there, and I said, okay, Doc, look in here at this first step. As I interpret, and that's as far as I got, boy, that step don't need your interpreting. It needs your doing. And that's the way we started through the steps. And you didn't pause between steps to contemplate your navel. When you finished one step, you went to the next one, and then to the next one, and then to the next one. There was no pausing. There was no stopping. I went to a meeting with a bunch of mostly newcomers, and it was on the fourth step. And the topic was, how do you know when you write a fourth step? Well, there were all kinds of theories came up, but the one that I liked the most and the one that seemed to make the most sense, he said, you're going to know when it's time to write a fourth step. There's a voice that's just inside. You're going to know when it's right for you, and then it's when you'll start doing it. I said, man, that's powerful. And I went back and shared that with Doc. He said, you're damn right you'll know, because I'm going to tell you. And he did. And we went to the fourth step. Then we got through with the fourth step, and we went to the fifth step. Then the sixth, then the seventh, then the eighth, then the ninth. It occurs to me, man, we are flying through these steps. We're going to be through here before you know it. And I walked into Doc's favorite trap. I said, Doc, what do you do when you get through working the steps? Without batting an eye, he said, son, when you get through working the steps, you lay real still because you're dead. In November of 1985, my sponsor, Doc, went on a 12-step call and never came home. As he and another man struggled to take a shotgun away from a suicidal young alcoholic that Doc had been trying to help, the shotgun accidentally discharged. Doc caught the blast full in the stomach and died before he reached the hospital. That evening in his den, I sat and I had a fear come over me I had not felt in a long time. I felt a loneliness gripping me from all sides. How can I go on? How can I stay sober without the man who planted me in this program, who dragged me kicking through these steps, who put these principles and ingrained them into my very being? How can I go on? And in the quiet stillness of that evening, the answer came, you'll do it by doing what he taught you to do. And what his sponsor taught him, and his sponsor before him taught him, and his sponsor before him. All the way back to the fateful night in the spring of 1935. On May 11th of 1935, when the broken-down stockbroker and the has-been doctor looked at each other in that little library in the Cyberling Gatehouse and said, do you think we might stay sober if we help one another? In the days and weeks after Doc's death, I was surrounded by the greatest, most wonderful little bunch of snotty-nosed sponsees that anybody could ever have. Those little guys dragged me to meetings when I didn't want to go. They put their arms around me when I wanted to isolate. They made me share when I wanted to hide. And they loved me and cared for me until I could walk the walk again. Now, after that, I wish I could tell you that I did the next right thing, but I didn't. I looked around endlessly for a clone of Doc. And, of course, he didn't exist. So for a year and a half, I did something I do not recommend. I sponsored myself. Now, a person who sponsors himself is dangerous. And it took me that long to wake up to the realization that I had a fool for a sponsor and an even bigger fool for a sponsee. I didn't know where to find a sponsor. My first sponsor, Doc, had a habit of making me treat what he called my secondary illness. He called it my terminal uniqueness. And he kept saying, one of these days you're going to wake up and discover you're nothing but a garden variety drunk. But till then, we're going to deal with your terminal uniqueness of how different you are. You need to have some acceptance, boy. And when he'd say that, I knew what was coming. He'd say, for the next month, I want you to go read pages 448 and 449 in the big book. And I want you to read it out loud to yourself every day for a month. I think he did that either three or four times, I'm not sure which. Enough times that I said, if I ever meet the son of a gun that wrote those words, I'm going to punch his friggin' lights out. I was invited to speak at a gathering called the Cornhusker Roundup in Omaha, Nebraska one year. And I walked in the hotel, picked up the program for the weekend. I had not seen who the other speakers were. And I turned to my wife and I said, looky here. One of the other speakers is Dr. Paul O. She said, who's that? I said, it's him. I'm going to get him. Well, I'm going to make a long story short. I met him that weekend. Didn't punch him. Nice guy. Less than a month later, I'm talking at a conference in northern Pennsylvania at a roundup there. They put all the speakers for that weekend in one house at this retreat center. Guess who's right across the hall? Paul and Max. About 5 weeks after that, I'm in Longview, Texas. Another conference, another talk, another weekend. And you guessed it, he's there. And it was that weekend at that thing in Texas that Paul walked up to me and said, Bill, we're having the anniversary of my home group in Laguna Beach come October. How about coming out and sharing your story at our anniversary? Now, folks, I did not plan what I said. I did not mean to say what I said. If I had thought for a minute, I would not have said what I said. But what came out of my mouth was, yes, I'll come talk if you'll be my sponsor. And for the last 10 years of his life, that wonderful little man was a truly wonderful, dear sponsor. We had a unique sponsor relationship. We saw each other out on the trail of AA conferences three or four times a year. We talked on the phone twice a week, and then we emailed every day. Every night I'd get home from a meeting. I'd jot a little about my day into the computer and hit the send button. 3 hours later, he'd get home from his meeting on the West Coast, and he would read it and answer it. The next morning, I would wake up with a message from my sponsor. And I've saved a few thousand of those, and one of these days, I'm going to take some of the personal things out and maybe share some of the wisdom of that wonderful man. He taught me and my wife so much about loving and laughing and about acceptance and about relationships. And I'll always be grateful for the 10 years that God allowed that man to be a part of my life. I did get to do one thing very gratifying. One day, he normally called me on Thursday, and the call didn't come until Friday. And he said, "You notice you didn't get an email from me this morning?" "I did, Paul." "And I didn't call you yesterday?" "No, I didn't. Is everything okay?" He said, "No, it's not." He said, "We're redoing the floors all over the house. They've got all of the carpets pulled up and rolled up against the wall. The tiles ripped up the floor in the kitchen. Max is in the kitchen right now yelling at the tile guy for bringing the wrong color. Sabrina, their little dog who happens to be blind, is bumping into everything because nothing's where it's supposed to be. No, everything's not okay." And in my mind, my voice is saying it, "Bill, this is your chance." And I opened my mouth and said, "Paul, maybe you need to go read page 449. Oh, that felt so good. In May 27th, 2000, Paul was called home to the angels. And I did not wait a year and a half. The very next day, I called a man named Dick Martin from Bellevue, Nebraska, to be my sponsor. And he's been my sponsor for the last 10 years, and a dear, wonderful sponsor he is, too. I believe in sponsorship. I love sponsorship. How am I doing? Okay. I can wrap it all up in less than that. I believe in sponsorship because sponsors have saved my life through the years. And I believe that the thing more or is equal to being a miracle, and I am a miracle, all of us are, equal to the wonder of that is getting to participate in somebody else's miracle. And I want to share just one example with you of a young man that I've been fortunate enough to get to participate in his miracle. About 20 years ago, a strapping 6'4" young African-American man walked up to me and looked down and said, "Would you be my sponsor?" And I went, "Uh-huh." And I agreed, and this young man and I started a journey together, and I learned he had been a dope dealer on the streets of Atlanta and an alcoholic. He'd got arrested when he tried to sell a stolen car to an undercover cop. He was hauled into DeKalb County Jail, and he was tried and sentenced. He served some time, and in jail he was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he came out and had asked me to sponsor him. And then he told me, he said, "I think I'm going to go back to school." He'd quit college because he found he could make more money selling dope. He said, "Okay, it's a lofty ideal, but go ahead and go for it." He did, and he finished college. And he got through with that, and he said, "I'm going to go to law school." And I went, "All right, go for it." And he did. And he finished law school. And he went to work for a prestigious law firm in Atlanta. And a couple of years after that, he broke off. And he and another man started their own law firm. 3 years ago, that young man was sworn in as a judge in the same courtroom where he had been sentenced. And last October, he was licensed to practice law before the United States Supreme Court. Now, you can't get here from where he came from, but by the grace of God. I believe when we attach ourselves to the principles of this program and we abide by its teachings, that we blow the lid off of the possibilities for our lives. We can achieve anything we set our minds and hearts to doing with God's blessing. I look at my own life. I had a marriage that was destroyed and am told by more than one marriage counselor that it was hopeless to give it up. But you see, God had other plans. The God of our understanding put my wife and me back together again. And in December of 1982, on the day divorce papers were to have been signed instead, we stood before the same minister who had married us 16 years earlier, and we renewed our vows, and we started all over again. And with God's grace, come December of this year, we will celebrate 44 years of happy ever aftering, thanks to AA. The little girl who hated my guts and wanted her daddy dead has given me two beautiful, wonderful grandsons. One of them even has my name. And I have a wonderful relationship with that little girl. I was not the greatest daddy in the world for the first 12 years of her life. I've tried to make amends for the last 28. But I can tell you this. My wife and I are damn good grandparents. We never give those boys anything in the world they don't want. Now, I want to tell you about my wife. I've been married to her for 43 and a half years, and I am still amazed by this wonderful woman. She showed me the way to Alcoholics Anonymous. She did it quietly. She did it resolutely. She did it by example and by attraction. And she continues to do that to this day. Today, we're fighting a hard, terrifying battle. We're battling cancer with her. And she's just been through 8 weeks of hell of chemotherapy and radiation. And I've watched her do it with courage and with grace. And I continue to be amazed. Would you stand up, honey? We have learned so much in these months. We've learned those things that are important in this world and those things that are not. And the things are not. Now, I did find it. I was sitting at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous one night. And, you know, when the readings are being read, we don't pay attention to them. We're thinking about something else. Unless somebody makes a mistake and we go, hmm? What'd he say? One night I was listening, and a man was reading and who said, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it. And then I knew the it that I had searched all my life for was right here in these rooms with you people. And my wife and I have found it in this fellowship, in dealing with what we're going through now. Because you see, we're not dealing with it alone. I don't have to deal with anything in my life today alone. You told me I'd never, ever, ever have to be alone again, and I haven't. My wife and I have received over 3,500 well wishes and prayers from all over the world. They've come from Ireland, from New Zealand, from Australia, from all across Canada, from all across the United States, from wonderful people in this fellowship, extending prayers and extending love. And those sustain us and they hold us up. But what a lot of people don't realize is those who live in Atlanta and the girls that Marlene sponsors in her recovery, it kind of amuses me to hear people call to cheer her up. They end up being the ones cheered up by her courage and by the love and happiness that she has in her life. We don't know what the future holds. We know what we want and we know what we pray for. We also know that God's will be done and we will deal with whatever comes along. But we've learned to enjoy every single moment of this world that we have. I used to say, I know everything's going to be okay. I know tomorrow's going to work out. And Dr. Paul used to say to me, Bill, you've almost got it. Things are not going to be okay. They are okay. Everything is exactly the way it's supposed to be today. It may be different tomorrow. My late sponsor used to hear people say in meetings that stupid little line of today is the first day of the rest of your life. he would say, that's dumb. Today may be the last day of the rest of your life, and you better live it like it is. Milk it for all it's worth. Get all of the goodies that it has to offer. And if all you came for here was to quit drinking, you got it. As for me, I want all the goodies that this program has got to offer. And they keep coming and they keep coming. They say don't quit before the miracle happens. I say don't quit before the first miracle. And then fasten your seatbelt. Because they keep coming and they keep coming and they keep coming. And they never stop. As I said, I don't know what our future holds. But I do know this. God has not brought us this far to drop us now. He will sustain us. And we'll be calling on you. As we always have and we always do. Help us keep walking this walk. And every morning I get up and I pray a similar prayer to what I've prayed for the last 28 years. And it's simply this. Thank you, God. Because I almost missed all this. Thank you and God bless.